Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Baseball America podcast, our first one of 2012, J.J. And we want to remind people that the 2012 handbook went to press recently.
Prospect
the 2012
handbook.
Almanac is out. And if you want to get those, any of your 2012 books, you can go to the Baseball America store. Just visit baseballamerica.com/store. And check out all the Baseball America books. We'll soon have our super register and our directory as well to complete the Baseball America cornucopia of book goodness.
Got an email from a reader yesterday asking, so how close is the handbook? And it's not here yet.
The handbook,
but
the PDF.
Close.
The handbook PDF is on all of our hard drives.
And sorry guys, we did
not to
sell
be shared.
That. Yeah,
exactly.
We did not sell that. But the handbook itself, we are in the final stages, the final proofing stages, so it's not far away.
Yeah, it's at the printer. So I would expect that it will ship by the end of January at the absolute latest. So very excited to have that project in our rearview mirror.
Yes.
Still cranking out top 10 prospect lists. Had our first chat of the week, of the new year yesterday as we record this on Thursday. But we had our first chat with the Yankees chat. We'll have Jim Callis. We start off the new year with Yankees and Red Sox. So that's kind of a double-barreled action. Then goes out with a whimper with the Orioles. Top 10, no offense to Will Lingo, who I do believe at the end of doing the Orioles top 30 this year said, I think I don't want to do the Orioles anymore. And I think Will has done the Orioles list every year since I've worked at Baseball America.
I was gonna say,
so
that he goes back to...
It's the longest streak, I think, that we have of anybody.
Because it precedes the handbook.
It precedes the handbook.
The handbook we've been doing since 1999.
It covers the 2000, I think, was the first one.
Into
the
2000 season.
It spans the Jim Callis interregnum, where Jim didn't work here for a couple of years. So, yeah, I think that Will doing the Orioles is the longest one. I think that Will has been doing the Orioles since they stopped winning. And that's the real problem, is that he has never done an Orioles top 10 while they've had a winning season.
I think also that Will's done the Orioles long enough now that I don't know if there's an Orioles employee still there.
Probably
besides
not.
Besides Peter Angelos, the owner.
Yeah, there's got to be a couple. There's got to be a couple of Angelos lackeys in there. I'm not sure what the Greek word is for lackey.
There's no one prominent in the front office who's still around from those days.
Yeah, it's not a good thing. But the Orioles, let's start, J.J. Well, we're going to talk American League East top prospects. We'll probably wind up starting with Baltimore at the bottom. But it's been a little bit more news. There's been a little bit more news in the last couple of weeks after Christmas and the first week. It was an active trade market right before and after Christmas at the major league level. Let's talk a little bit about those deals, specifically the ones that Oakland made. We could talk about the Reds as well. I think we may have covered that in the last podcast.
Let's go on the A.
Oakland's trades, I think, are more interesting.
We talked
anyway.
About the Reds with the NL West because that worked into that.
Correct. But Oakland, and Jim Callis actually wrote a column that will be on the website first of next week about the A's. And we've seen the complaints. So that's the only way I can – the only word I think that's fair to use is complaints by Billy Beane that, well, our window, it never opened up this time. We have to, our window's a couple of years down the line. It's much harder for us to compete. So the A's really – I mean, is there any reason at all for anyone in the East Bay – to buy a season ticket for the Oakland A's until 2014, wherever the A's are going to be located?
Depending on where you live, you may not be.
But for the next 2 years, they're going to be in Oakland, we're pretty sure. Why would anyone buy a ticket to watch that team? They've basically publicly said, we have no shot to compete. And then on the other end, they go and spend $14 million over 2 years on Coco Crisp as a free agent, which seemed like they did that at the behest of the union to have a minimum, floor of their – Major League salary. It's ridiculous.
It is interesting, but it does seem like that one of the things that has recently been established is there is not a, and the union does not want an actual salary floor because
right.
they don't want an actual salary cap at the
right.
top either. But effectively, there is somewhat of one now, it does appear. I mean, maybe that move is pretty low. Maybe that move was not, but we've seen in the past, we've seen like the Marlins agreed,
right.
hey, we've got to spend some money here.
But Coco Crisp. I don't want to get too sidetracked, but Coco Crisp at 32 for $14 million, $7 million each year. It doesn't fit with the rest of the things the Athletics are doing.
Beyond the fact that one, you may be hearing something about hey, you got to spend some money, and two, you still got to have someone out there. If you don't put in someone in center field, the ball goes to the wall and off the
line. That's right. Another part of it is that Oakland doesn't have any other – they've decided, instead of investing in their own players they had, they decided to punt 2 years down the line. And that brings us to the trades. The three players they've had who made All-Star games the last couple of years are all gone. Andrew Bailey, Gio Gonzalez, Trevor Cahill. The Cahill trade happened a long time ago. Let's focus on the Gonzalez and the Bailey trades, because JJ really seems like – Billy Bean did do something fairly skillfully with Gio Gonzalez, which is there's not a big free agent pitching market. He made Gonzalez available, built up the Gio Gonzalez market, and got the Nationals, who are desperate to be relevant, to pay up with four of their top 13 prospects.
Oh, I think it's a nice haul for Gio. I think if you look at these trades, the best trade for the A's of all these trades is the Gio Gonzalez trade. Yeah. Not that Gonzalez is not good, because he is. Little control issues and all that, but still... 26-year-old lefty with that kind of stuff who's had success like he's had the last 2 years.
Yeah, he's proven durable and effective at the major league level. Yes, he did lead the major leagues in walks last year. But
you'll still take that. He's not a number one, but you know what? The great thing for the Nationals, they don't need him to be a number one.
Yeah, I think the Nationals, he's a very nice complement to Strasburg and Zimmerman as a nice lefty complement in the front third of that rotation.
But for the A's, if you get back what they got back, which you got a guy who basically steps in and replaces him in the rotation in Brad Peacock.
Right. Not as good. Right.
But
I like Brad Peacock.
But a very solid, I think we both would agree.
I don't see any difference really between Brad Peacock and Jared Parker in terms of their prospect status. Peacock has the better fastball. Parker has better breaking stuff. They're the same age. And Peacock... For me, he's had a little bit more success.
Parker has a better pedigree, but that doesn't get you guys out in the big leagues.
Yeah, I mean, he has a better pedigree in that he was drafted higher. But as far as their track records in pro ball, Peacock's, especially if you're what have you done for me lately, Peacock hasn't had surgery, and he was better at upper levels in 2011. So I actually prefer Peacock, but they're both, to me, they're basically the same type of prospect.
I'll put it this way.
They're two-three starters.
When you're putting other top 100, those guys aren't going to be too far apart.
Yeah, absolutely. And A.J. Cole in that deal has the highest ceiling probably of anyone the Nationals gave up in that trade.
Right. And essentially, they got the guy who plugs in the rotation.
Right.
In Tom Malone, they got the guy who you can plug in the rotation if you need another guy.
Hey, Tom Malone, go talk to Dallas Braden about surviving in the major leagues with below-average stuff.
Low ceiling, no doubt about that.
Yep.
But, those guys do have value, a guy like that, because he can pitch in the big leagues for you right now. He may put up an 85 ERA plus, but he could give you 30 starts if you need him, which they may need them.
The A's are hoping he has a John Halama type of career.
Right. Well,
John Halama.
And then you've got, as far as the other pitcher in this, you've got the lottery ticket, which is A.J. Cole could end up being better than Gio Gonzalez.
Yeah, the low A ball, live-armed, former high school pick, high school guy who entered the 2010 draft in the mix to be the top high school pitcher in that class. He had a little bit of a down spring, but I was pretty encouraged by his first full season, so... And when you're trading a guy like Gio Gonzalez to get four prospects like that, we didn't even mention Derek Norris.
And they got Derek Norris, who
the best 2010 season in the minor leagues last year.
Although
if
you have a concern with that, the A's have traded for the Derek Norris type player, it seems like, a whole lot of times recently.
Guys who walk a lot?
Questionable defensive catchers who walk a lot.
The one thing that he can do.
Josh Donaldson, Derek Barton. And now Derek Norris.
Yeah, Derek Norris is much more of a catcher than Barton ever was, because Barton stopped catching pretty early in the minor leagues, didn't he? And at least the one thing that Norris can do...
But he was a catcher when the A's acquired him.
Right, but he was in a low A. Yeah. Norris, I think if he didn't lead the Eastern League and caught stealings, he was close to it.
Right, but he's still not considered...
He's not considered an above-average defensive catcher. There's no doubt about that. He is athletic, and he has improved defensively. I think he's going to be a catcher. I think he's more of a catcher than Derek Barton ever was.
Right.
But I think... And Josh Donaldson, for that matter. He's better than those two guys, for me. He's the best of those guys. I'm kind of a Derek Norris fan as well. He's athletic. Yeah, the guy stole 13 bags last year. He does... Not hit for high average, but he consistently walks. He consistently hits for power. He hit like 20 home runs and 370 at bats last year. He's an Oakland A's. He's a 10 years ago Oakland A's kind of player. He walks. He hits home runs. And defensively, he's a good offensive player. I mean, that's what he is. So I like Derek Norris. I thought that was a pretty impressive deal for Oakland. The Andrew Bailey trade, I guess, if you've already traded away your numbers one and two starters, you really don't need a closer. You're not going to contend, so trade the closer. What do we think of Miles Head and Alcantara that they got from the Red Sox?
I'm not as impressed with the haul they got from the Red Sox, but at the same time, I don't think Andrew Bailey's worth as nearly as much.
Right.
So
obviously, they left out Josh Reddick. They swapped Josh Reddick and Ryan Sweeney.
I had a front office official for another team say that one of the more impressive things that Billy Bean has done in recent years is that if you are a bad team, make a young guy the closer.
Right.
And then a couple of years,
a little value.
And then a couple of years later, trade him away, and then you can always go and make another guy a closer, and he may have added value because he can prove they can close.
Right.
So they've done this now on multiple occasions. So
pretty interesting for Boston also as we go to the American League East a little bit, JJ, that they've rebuilt their bullpen with losing Papelbon, and they're talking about moving both Bard and Aceves, especially Aceves. I'm pretty convinced they're going to move Aceves to the rotation. I'm not as convinced on Bard. But now Bobby Jenks has another back surgery or a complication from a back problem. But Melanson and Andrew Bailey, that's, you know, Papelbon has done it and did it and won a World Series as a closer. I don't know. I mean, obviously the Red Sox expectations for Andrew Bailey and Mark Melanson are going to be pretty high, but I like both those guys. I especially like Melanson from a makeup standpoint, and I like Bailey's makeup and what he's overcome and his stuff. He's closed and been very effective as a closer in the big leagues. It's not a bad way to rebuild, and it's a cheap way to rebuild.
A cheap way to rebuild, and they've now got the other thing you have is you have two of those guys, which is always valuable from the standpoint of three of those guys, really, because if Bard ends up in the pen also,
right.
You're not in a situation. The thing you want to avoid, and, you know, look, you want to debate about, you know, yes, you can make there's something about closing, but at the same time,
sure,
there is an aura that goes with, oh, that guy's closed, that sometimes goes a little far because everyone, to become a closer at some point, you had to become a closer.
Right, exactly.
That being said, one of the worst things that can happen, it seems like, for a team that considers itself a contender is if you have all your eggs in one basket as far as, you know, your bullpen.
Right.
And then that one reliever gets hurt. And then all of a sudden, a lot of teams seem like they get into desperate straits. I think of the Twins a couple of years ago.
Absolutely.
And you're just like, Joe Nathan. No Joe Nathan. We're desperate.
And then
here's Wilson Ramos.
They overpaid for the quote-unquote proven closer, which Matt Capps really wasn't
proven
even the proven
was,
closer.
Yeah, if you're a bad team, everyone has someone who finishes up the games.
That's right. That illustrates exactly what you're talking about.
But you avoid that if you're the Red Sox, especially in the Boston market. If Papelbon, and he wasn't, because they had Bard, they had a couple other, but if Papelbon had been the only guy, and he gets hurt, and you have no other options, well then, in that market, the screams that are going to come, you know, from everyone about got to go out and get a closer, you're not going to see that this year, because if it's Bailey who's the guy, or it's Bard who's the guy, or it's Melanson who's the guy, and he gets hurt, you go, okay, well, whoever's been pitching the eighth for us is now going to pitch the ninth. Whoever's pitching the seventh is now going to pitch the eighth.
You have three plan Bs, basically. I think Bailey will be plan A. But I think that makes – to me, I think Ben Cherington gets pretty good marks for his first big moves as the general manager in remaking their bullpen.
Especially, again, because what we talked about, if you look at it, the Red Sox got Bailey. And there's nothing that they gave up for Bailey that you would say – okay, that guy, you point to him and say that was going to be a key part of the Red Sox.
Because I like Josh Reddick, but I think the Red Sox internally liked Ryan Kalish better, and Ryan Kalish was hurt last year. If Ryan Kalish is healthy, he basically stepped right into that right field vacancy. It'll be interesting to see what Boston does.
And I'll say this, even the Melanson trade.
Yeah, like, Jed Lowry was not going to be their starting shortstop. It was going to be Marco Scudero. So you're basically trading a utility guy. And I thought it was a good move for Houston as well.
If you're the Astros, it's like, hey, this Jed Lowry immediately becomes one of the better players
Marwin
on your
Gonzalez
roster.
Or Angel Sanchez or Jed Lowry at shortstop.
Jed Lowry. The answer is Jed Lowry.
Well, Boston did not trade any of their top 10 prospects in that, JJ. So let's talk about the Orioles briefly.
Let's start with the Orioles, which I think we agree.
And then we'll go to Boston. But yeah,
worst farm system of this group.
Number five in the big league standings, and number five in the farm systems.
And that being said, crazy thing about this is I don't think this is a good farm system, But I do think you could argue this is the best that the Orioles farm system has looked at the top. The top two guys are, I know they had Weeders, and I know they've had a lot of pitching, but the top two guys on this list are potentially, they have two top 10 prospects.
But wasn't the year that they, that Weeders was an 07 draft, so he had his big year, his Chuck Norris year in 2008, and that year they drafted Brian Mattis.
So that's,
they probably had both those guys.
That was two top 10 guys in too, probably.
So I would say that was probably two top 10 guys as well.
But there aren't many teams, and we haven't done our top 100 obviously yet.
Right.
But it's, I'm comfortable saying.
Sorry. I'm looking back at the 2008 handbook where Matt Weeders was number one when he had just been drafted. Number two, Rodimus Liz. Number three, Troy Patton. Nolan Reimold, Bill Rowell, Brandon Snyder, Jake Arrieta, Corey Spoon, Pedro Beato, Brandon Irby.
This is the point.
Poochie mama.
This is the point that, this is the problem with the Orioles, is that even what we're talking about right now, I really like prospect number one, Dylan Bundy.
Yeah.
I really like prospect number two, Manny Machado. I really like, not the same level, but I really like Jonathan Scope, who's number three on their list.
Yeah, yeah. Zach Britton, number 21 that year after being in the Appy League.
And after that, though, there are a whole lot of guys who don't look like they should be. Parker Bridwell should not be a number four prospect.
No. No. He's like a guy you'd love to have him number 10.
The best way to put it is Ryan Flaherty, who was not protected by the Cubs, is number seven. Rule five draft. Not a whole lot of Rule 5 picks crack top 10s.
No, not very often. I do remember losing a top 10 guy in the Rule 5 draft when I did the first year I did a top 10. The Blue Jays number 10 guy was Jay Gibbons, and he got Rule 5 that year by the Orioles, and he went straight to their top 10, like his number 10. But that was like a number, you know, and even in the write-up when I wrote him up for the Blue Jays, I guess he didn't go, he must have gone in the book. But even when I wrote him up for the Blue Jays, it was, you know, he wasn't protected on the 40-man roster because they have Carlos Delgado, but he had a big year in Double-A. And anyway, I always enjoyed Jake Gibbons being in the top 10 and getting Rule 5'd.
But not often.
Ryan Flaherty, he was in the 11 to 20 range very comfortably for the Cubs.
And the scariest thing that with the Orioles, and they themselves seem to admit this because they keep trying to fix this, but one of the problems is that their guys, they have not had a whole lot of guys who you say, that guy got a lot better.
Correct. That's a very fair assessment. They don't have a lot of guys. Jonathan Scope is one of the few, but again, let's see him do it at Double-A. But like L.J. Hose. L.J. Hose would probably rank third on this list if he could play second base, or at least he'd rank fourth.
But he
really can't. I don't know why we even listed him as an OF/2B, because he can't play second base. He's a great example, or Xavier Avery. After 3 or 4 years in their farm system, is still thought of as a raw, toolsy athlete with really no real significant improvement in his swing. The biggest problem with the Orioles, JJ, is you look at their 2009 draft. That's the one year. Most years, the Orioles have had a good first-round pick. You look at their list of the first-rounders, Weeders, Mattis, Machado, Bundy. For the last 5 years, they've spent money, they've drafted high. And, you know, Mattis had a horrible year in the big leagues, but he certainly has flashed. You see why
he
was picked there.
And we did a story in this issue.
Right.
Know, it's been up on the site also about just how the key for the Orioles to win the division or anything like that.
Just to be
respectable. But the key for respectability is that their crop of pitching prospects, who are now all in the big leagues, Dylan Bundy's not part of that crop, but that crop of pitching prospects who – all of them.
The Arriettas.
Almost without fail, fell on their face in 2011.
Yeah, the Brad Bergesons. I mean, even him.
David Hernandez pitched really well out of the pen, but the only problem is it wasn't for Baltimore.
That's right. But if you're looking at their – if you want to pinpoint a reason why their farm system is in such bad shape right now, the biggest thing would be the 2009 draft.
Because Matt Havgood at the top. And
yeah, because in 2009, that's the one year, JJ, out of all these years, where they actually went aggressively over slot frequently. And Joe Jordan's no longer the scouting director there. And, you know, Joe, I'm sure he had his strong points. But if you're just looking track record, that draft looks terrible. I don't have the whole draft in front of me. But I know the guys that went over slot for, they saved money with Hobgood. And they went over slot with guys like Michael Ullman, Cameron Coffey, a couple other guys. None of those guys are in their top 30. Michael Givens, not top 10. Four guys I can think of off the top of my head. Givens, Hobgood, Coffey, and Ullman, who got $800,000 or above, where Hobgood got slot, but he was an overdraft. The other three guys, They saved money in the first round. They went over slot with the other guys. Not only are those guys not in their top 10, they're not in their top 30. So
and
that
we're talking 2.5 years later.
So that draft was a complete whiff, and that draft is the reason. I mean, you can't write off those players completely, but that draft is the biggest reason why their farm system stinks right now.
And this is the thing, is that if you are a great farm system and you whiff on one draft, you can survive it.
Right.
If you're a good farm system and you whiff on one draft, you're going to really feel it. But if you're already a below-average farm system and you whiff on a draft,
that's it. You just can't afford it.
It takes you a long time to make up for that.
Yeah, and that's it. So I shouldn't say that's the only reason. And their system doesn't stink. I shouldn't be that hard on it.
They're not going to rank 30th.
I do have future stars, and I like Dylan Bundy. I think I had Dylan Bundy ranked higher on my personal top 50 than anybody else from the 2011 draft. But that 2009 draft is the biggest reason why the depth in their farm system is poor.
And the problem they have is that when we go through this, I mean, there aren't – that's the only below-average farm system in the AL East.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that's actually what it is.
That's a real problem is that you're the worst team in the division, and then you add on top of that, you know, at the big league level. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you have – not just the worst farm system, but you have a bad farm system or below average farm system in a division where everyone else is above average.
Yeah, where everybody else spends money, and if they don't spend money, they're creative. And if they don't, I mean, like even the Rays don't spend a ton of money in the draft as far as going way over slot, but they had more picks than anybody else because they really gamed the system and the old system, and Baltimore has not done that either. Moving on with a little bit happier face to Boston. JJ, this is a weird farm system because they're like the opposite of Baltimore. Dylan Bundy or Manny Machado would rank one very easily in the Red Sox
system.
And
the other one would rank two.
Dylan
Bundy and Manny Machado would be 1-2.
Absolutely.
They'd be ahead of anyone in this system.
Absolutely. And it doesn't mean I don't think there's star power in the Red Sox system. I think that Xander Bogaerts is very comparable to like Reimer Liriano with the Padres, where they both ranked second in their farm system, but they have the highest ceilings, but there's a lot more uncertainty. We don't know what position
Xander Bogaerts, low-A guys who are farther away, you know.
And Xander Bogaerts, for all his power, struck out in, 28% of his at-bats last year.
I'll say this, though. If you're going to strike out that slug over 500 in the side league as an 18-year-old, that's
absolutely.
It's like, okay, I'll give you some holes there. You know, Mike Stanton struck out a lot as an 18-year-old. I mean, as a 19-year-old, I think, in the
side league. He was 18. Giancarlo Cruz, Mike Stanton, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and you'll take that because if you show that kind of power,
no doubt,
you got a carrying tool.
He has the highest ceiling. Will Middlebrooks, nice prospect. Blake Swihart, I've heard raves from people who saw him in instructional league. I believe in Blake Swihart's bat. I don't know if he's going to catch, but I really believe in his bat.
I believe he is the only top 10 prospect who carries currently an 0-0-0 stat line.
That's right. Wow, 0-for-6. I didn't notice that. I thought that said 0-for-0. I was wondering why we even ran that stat line. But their system has so much depth, JJ, of interchangeable parts where it's really the guys who rank like 15th in their system could rank 4th.
The best way to put it is Anthony Renato's 4, and I'm not an Anthony Renato fan. Let me make that clear, as people in the office know. Nothing personal against him, but a lot of injuries there.
Anthony Renato killed my brother.
But the best way to put it is Anthony Renato's 4. When you're putting together top hundreds, he's not. I know he's not going to be on my top 100.
Yeah, I don't think he's going
to
be on
mine. I don't think he's going to be on yours.
I do think that Brandon Jacobs and Bryce Brentz might be on my top 100.
But the thing I was going to say is that if you said, okay, now rank your top 200, their number 9 guy, Ryan LaVarnway, might make my top, my number 2, my top 200.
He'll make my top 150 because Matt Barnes, actually, at number 8, he might be in my top 100. He might be in the 90s for me. Because, I mean, how is he that different from too many of the college pitchers who went this year? He's a little less refined than the breakings. The secondary stuff's not as refined as some of the other top college pitchers in the 2011 draft class. But I thought he was a steal where Boston got him. And you could make a case for him 4. And let's just also say,
their number 10 prospect, Jackie Bradley, not right now, but a year from now, if shows health.
Well, he could be a top 100 guy.
He could be easily a top 100 guy next year if he's healthy and he has kind of the year. He basically picks up from his sophomore year, he's just jumped to now.
We got to see the bat. Exactly. We got to see the bat play the way it did when he was a sophomore, not the way it did in 2011 when even before he got hurt, he wasn't hitting great. And again, my comp for Jackie Bradley Jr. has been for a year or so Mark Kotze. I'm looking for him to be Mark Kotze. So,
Without the pitching ability.
Well, yeah, that goes without saying. Well, who knows? You know, he doesn't hide the ball like Michael Roth. They never gave him the shot at South Carolina. But Jackie Bradley Jr., as a premium defensive player in center field, and I think has that great player aura without the great player tools, which was what Mark Kotze had at Cal State Fullerton. Oh, he's a great player at Cal State Fullerton. But he had a very nice big league career. I think if Jackie Bradley Jr. Hits like Mark Kotze.
If he produces a Mark Kotze career, that's a great draft pick.
Absolutely. But I do think out of last year's, I like the fact that Jim Callis does our Red Sox list. If you're going to pick someone from their draft class from last year, I would have ranked Blake Swihart as the highest guy. I don't know if he's a sleeper, but I like Brandon Jacobs a little bit better than 60. I'd take Jacobs over Bryce Prince, for example.
I will say, though, so in the AL East, are they third to you, fourth? Okay,
I think I had them third. I think I went Yankees,
I agree
Blue
with you on
Jays,
Yankees one,
Red Sox,
Blue Jays two. And I know that there's going to be some Blue Jays fans who may hear this and go, wait, what? You know, and hey, the Blue Jays have a very deep farm system.
They do.
The thing that the Yankees, to me, and I think to you also, the thing that puts them ahead is that Toronto's farm system is deep, but at the top end, they don't have a Jesus Montero, a top 10 prospect guy.
Well, there's very few organizations that have as good a young pitching as the Jays have. You know, prospects 4 through 10 are all pitchers, and they all have pretty good upside.
Right, they're all, yeah, none of these are Triple A guys who you go, hey, he's crafty, he can figure it out.
And I like their top three guys in terms of ceiling. Darnot, Ghost, Mariznick. You know, I'd probably take Jake Mariznick over Gary Sanchez. That's tough, but I'd probably take Jake Mariznick over Gary Sanchez. It's number three versus number four.
Yeah, I would say they'd be close.
I bet there's some organizations where they would take Dellin Betances, and they would rather have Jake Mariznick than Dellin Betances. That said, to me, that pitcher class for Toronto, all those guys have some hickeys. You know, most of those guys haven't pitched those prospects 4 through 7 haven't pitched full season ball.
Yeah.
So that's a not for a full year.
Yeah. And Dave McGuire,
you know, he's a back rotation. He's a number four starter type. Drew Hutchison probably is as well, though I like him a little bit better than most.
And then
Asher Woj, I loved Asher Woj out of college, but let's face it, Asher Woj's arm was put through the ringer at Citadel.
And he did not have a good year.
I wouldn't even mention it for the fact that he really didn't have a good season. And it's not that he didn't perform. It's that his stuff was down. The sharpness of the stuff was down. So he's kind of a wild card number 10. There's all kinds of depth in Toronto, but I think the Yankees have more high ceiling talent.
When Asher Wojciechowski was in college, you did not see 89s coming out of his arm.
No, you saw bastard sliders, and you did not see bastard sliders out of him this year, not on a consistent basis. Whereas for me, the Yankees are looking at even a guy like Ravel Santana and Dante Bichette and Mason Williams. That middle column, when you look at your top 10 and you have prospects 5, 6, and 7, those three guys are really, really interesting. And the Blue Jays have that with pitchers, and I mean, you do have to have volume, and they do. The Yankees have that with bats with real upside, bats with athleticism, and Dante Bichette doesn't have.
And above that, they also have a pair of pitchers who, if not big league ready, are really close.
And that's the other thing, is that the Yankees do have, I think, more close to the majors ready to help talent.
Their top three guys are all guys who, if you said they broke camp with them at the end of spring training this year, you wouldn't be shocked.
Right, two guys were in the big leagues, and then don't forget Austin Romine is a very, you know, back there sitting at number 8. Is I think, you know, right on that cusp, when he gets to the big leagues, he's going to be right on that cusp of first division or second division catcher. He's going to be right in that. If you're starting Austin Romine, you're going to be thinking to yourself, can we do better than this guy or not? I think it really depends. He's a very streaky hitter historically in his minor league career. I like Romine. I would like to see him, you know, but he's not as good as Travis Darnot. But coming out of high school, those guys were regarded. They were very, very close together.
Right.
They're
the same
better. High school class.
Darnot's better now.
Darnot's better, there's no doubt. But I'm just saying, their pedigree's pretty similar. Darnot gets a significantly better prospect right now. But you know, Romine's been in our top 100 before, and I don't think he's going to be in the top 150 right now. But I think he has a chance to be a big league regular. So,
but the main thing to me,
upper levels
the main thing to me that jumps out, though, is you have three guys at the top for the Yankees One who's a top 10 prospect, yeah. I don't think. Two others who are...
I think Montero's in the top five for me. I mean, he's just... He's as elite as hitters get in the minor leagues. The only minor league hitters, to me, who are better are Trout and Harper. There's only minor league hitters who are better. And then you're basically, how much are you going to ding him for his defense and the fact that he's probably going to be more of a DH? But to me, his career path is going to be, he's going to be a better version of Paul Konerko. He'll probably wind up catching more in his career than Paulie, but yep. I think it's going to be a similar career path. And Paul Konerko has some 40 home run seasons in there, and he was a four-hole hitter for a World Series
champion. Which translates to
30
home run seasons now. You know?
I don't know.
I'm saying, but
yeah.
You know, if he puts up 30 home run seasons, that's equally
Paulie
what Konerko
did. Paulie hit 40 last year, didn't he, in 2011?
That's
and
true.
Paulie's still doing it.
Yeah.
So I've used that comparison for a couple of years because Paul Konerko is a guy who hits for average and power when he's going right, and that's going to be Jesus Montero. And if he's doing that as a first baseman or DH, or if he's doing it as a DH catcher where he's catching 40 games a year, I think Jesus Montero is going to be a pretty valuable player. So, and he fits what the Yankees need right now so very well. He's the perfect, to me, right-handed power bat complement to Granderson, Cano, Nick Swisher. The only power right-handed bat they have is A-Rod.
Don't worry. They're going to have A-Rod for the next
6 years.
Yeah,
as long as Montero is cheap, they will have A-Rod. So
actually, Montero might be expensive. You know,
that's right. By the time the A-Rod is as well, but Toronto's system, JJ, real quick. I mean, it's really more notable to me for depth than it is for star power. Even though I do like those top three.
I was going to say the thing about it is if we go top 10 here, if you get the prospect handbook, there are a number of guys in that prospect handbook. Past 10, who you also we like.
Put it this way, Nestor Molina was like in the mid-teens for the Blue Jays, and he got traded to the White Sox. He became their number two prospect.
Spoiler alert, you know, coming up ahead.
That's crazy that he went from like 18 to 2. That's a big jump. So very big difference in those farm systems. But I think Toronto's second, Boston third. Tampa is fourth, JJ, and that might surprise some people. But
and
I
can't remember.
Call.
I'm trying to think. When I did mine, I want to say I had them. I may have had them. I can't remember if I had them ahead of Boston or behind. I think those two are pretty close together. And the reason I say that again is maybe I'm putting too much weight to it. But the drop off between Matt Moore, number one prospect, and the Red Sox number one prospect is nothing against Will Middlebrooks. But it's, Matt Moore is as
it's huge.
Matt Moore.
Yeah.
It's funny, but we think back over the top pitching prospect year by year by year, and we have guys who like, man, that guy just looks amazing. David Price.
Right.
When it was the David Price, Matt Wieters comparison. You know what, though? Matt Moore is a better pitching prospect at this point than David Price was at the same point.
I don't think there's any doubt about
that. I don't think there's any question. And David Price was like the slam dunk best pitching prospect, and he's lived up to it. It's not something
right.
where you say, oh, well, but you know, Matt in hindsight, no. David Price was the number one pitching prospect without a doubt.
Yeah.
He was in the argument, the 1-2. He was either 1 or 2 in our top 100.
Yep.
That was the debate, him or Wieters. And you look at it now, you say he's lived up to what we expected. And you say, you look at this and go, yeah, and Matt Moore is significantly better.
I think he is significantly better. I mean, I guess I shouldn't say three grades. It's a grade and a half. But, I mean, you're talking about a guy who we think is going to be an above-average big league third baseman in Will Middlebrooks versus a guy who's going to be the best left-handed pitcher in the big leagues. And if he's not the best, he's going to be right there
discussion.
With Clayton Kershaw. I mean, he's right there. So, Matt Moore's special.
Hey. He's a pitcher. He could get hurt, obviously.
That's he's always, the safest pitcher in the book, too.
But you look at it and you say, he's already shown a taste of what he can do in the big leagues. Because, as I think either you or someone wrote, you know, with this, look, Matt Moore has already, in some ways, hit what our projection for him is, which is to be the number one starter on a playoff team. I know he wasn't their number one starter during the season, but
right.
You know what? When the playoffs rolled around, they said, who are we going to start? They started Matt Moore, and he was dominating.
Yeah, he was. He didn't just start the first game. That's not why you say that he looked like a number one starter on a playoff team. It wasn't just that he started the first game. He's shut out the defending pennant winners, the team that went on to win the pennant for 7 innings in their home stadium. You saw in the postseason – Chris Carpenter would labor for 6 innings to hold that Rangers lineup down. You saw other pitchers with big pedigrees try to hold that Rangers lineup.
You
in
saw
check,
a whole lot of games that
do
was
it.
Six. You know, like it was 6-5 in the
look
fourth.
Look at what he did. Look what the Rangers did to Justin Verlander. They made that guy work. The guy was MVP in Cy Young, and they made that guy work for every out. Matt Moore made that look so easy, so effortless. There was no one who cut through that Rangers lineup
and
better in the postseason.
Let's say there is an advantage.
So
of,
he's hit that season.
There is an advantage of when you're getting the. If you're a pitcher with his kind of stuff,
right.
And they're seeing you for the first time,
true,
giant advantage. I'll admit that.
True,
you can't watch video. Like there's so much video now. Well, we got some video. We got you know the camera. You know from we got some Durham Bulls art.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's not the same.
Well, he had that one 5-inning start right. or whatever against the Yankees. True, it harder to break him down. And obviously, the other part of being a number one starter is 200 innings. Go out there and be you know. To me, I guess you're going to put it in that 125 ERA plus. You want to see, can we still use wins or am I allowed or will I be laughed off the air? But you're looking for a guy who will win 15 to 20 games. You're looking for a guy to start 200, pitch 200 innings, strike
and
out a lot of guys.
He hasn't had to
he
pitch
hasn't
200
done that yet.
But because you're not going to have a guy throw 200 innings at the minors.
Even without that playoff, although we did have Terry Doyle do that
yes,
this year.
But...
Even without that playoff start, just look at what Matt Moore did just in the minor leagues. And that stat line at Durham is so ridiculous. And we got to see it, but it's still
I mean, the
so
best
ridiculous.
Way to, the best way to put it is
that boy good.
The funny thing about it is that Matt Moore, over the final 2 months of the season, Matt Moore, like, probably seeing him at his worst was seeing him in the AAA playoffs.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
was
you're
Matt
right.
Moore at his worst.
It was. Yeah, you're right. And the only thing he didn't get to do this year was pitching that AAA championship game in his hometown in Albuquerque that he wanted to do. That was the only goal that he didn't fulfill. So
but
kudos
the thing,
to
but
Matt Moore.
The thing that was jumping out from that is that he is so good
yeah.
that when you have a guy at that top level, to me, I might take that system. If you said, hey, I get everyone in the system, and you compare it to the Red Sox have better depth. The
I
Rays' depth
that.
Is not what it is not what it once was.
I could see that, though. I could see that argument.
But there still is some depth there. And the thing about it is that if you're giving me chance at a guy who – I mean, we don't want to go insane here, but the reality of it is a guy who we think this guy should – again, I don't want to overhype him, but
he should
we
be
expect
Verlander.
Him to be a multiple all-star,
yeah.
multiple competing for Cy Young.
He should be a Verlander or a Kershaw type of guy. I mean,
if
to put it in
if
this
I got a chance
vernacular.
Of that, I'm not saying there's no one in that Red Sox system who could end up being an MVP, multiple MVP type or anything. Maybe Xander Bogaerts if everything comes together.
Right.
But in Matt Moore's case, we're talking about a guy who's reached the big leagues and we think of like that. I might take that guy over a
yeah.
deeper system.
That's a fair argument to make.
But
you might have
but,
convinced me already.
But that being said, this is not the Rays top 30. You know, we got top 10 here, the top 30 for the handbook. This is not what you're talking about a couple of years ago.
And I think one of the reasons for that is you have to look at their last couple of drafts. And this year's draft, you know, we don't know
yet.
There are no returns of 2011. Certainly they had a good draft just because of the sheer volume of high picks.
Someone, if they don't
it's
get anyone out of
out.
This draft, something.
And let's
just say this also. With the Rays, they have enough of a track record that you can – when we say with the Orioles, there are not a whole lot of guys who've
right.
gotten better. With the Rays,
that's not the case.
There are a whole lot of guys, especially pitching-wise, who have gotten
said,
better.
That said, you can't draw too much of a conclusion from this. Jim Callis and I have talked about this. Since 2008, the Rays have been good. So there's one thing. 2008 was
right.
the first
not,
year they were
they're
good.
They're not drafting at the top. They're not drafting the top five
right.
anymore.
But that said, Matt Moore was drafted in 2007. They haven't had a player from the 2008 draft get to the big leagues yet, or 2009 or 2010. I understand they draft higher ceiling, high athlete, raw, or more raw players in general. You know, and Tim Beckham is you know, he restored some of his lost prospect luster. I realize I'm the in-house Tim Beckham apologist.
Yes, you are.
Compared to everybody else. Alex Torres was in a drafted guy. He got to the big leagues this year, albeit briefly. To me, though, they really haven't drafted great the last 3 years.
The best way to put it is that the only guy from the 08, 09, you know, drafts who's in their top 10 that they drafted is Tim Beckham.
Right. And, you know, 09, I guess, you're not. It's going to be harder to have a good draft when you don't sign your first and second round picks. Well, they didn't. They didn't sign LaVon Washington that year. They didn't sign Kenny DeKroger.
You know what? And I'll say this with LaVon Washington. I've never been a LaVon Washington fan.
Yeah.
That may have worked out well for them in that.
Yeah, I don't even think he made the Indians' top 10 this year. And let me tell you, the Indians' top 10,
not...
the bar was low there. The bar was low. They traded everybody, and the bar was low. So, but they, you know, you, I think it's fair to critique Tampa's the impression that people have of the Rays organization is that they always draft well and develop well, and they have, for the most part, they have done that. But right now, their system looks like after Matt Moore, who will be their number one prospect at this time next year? More than likely, you'd think it's either going to be Hawk Julie, maybe Chris Archer doesn't break into the big leagues. He's got a higher ceiling.
I was going to say, or you could
throw I would actually bank on Guerrero.
I was going to say, Taylor Guerrero is the guy who I would expect to, you know, to be the number one prospect in their system next year.
Right.
Because if he goes out and has the season that he could have, you could, a year from now, going, okay, you know, he, and I'll say this, though, but he would be then, he if he is their number one next year, that would be, that's not a top 20, top 25 prospect, number one, probably.
Probably not. I mean, he has pretty loud stuff, but I mean, but there are a lot of makeup like, issues about Taylor Guerrero, maturity issues.
What they have now that they have going for him is that they have this very good big league club, and they're going to add Matt Moore, who should step in and pitch very well right away. And go sure. on top of that, they have a Colomay, they have a Torres, who aren't far away from being able to help as well. But what they don't have now is the reality of this is that they had gaping holes at multiple positions last year, and they don't have a whole lot of position players who you turn to. And the guys they've drafted, who admittedly should be a ways away, but they've had several of those guys who they very prominent top round picks in recent years, position
right.
player wise, who have yet to get anything going.
Yeah, really, guys like a Lucas Bailey, a Justin O'Connor, Josh Sale. You know, to a lesser extent, Drew Vettelson, he's in the top 10. But yeah, their last couple of drafts, their high-end draft picks have not done a whole lot. Like in 2009, again.
I mean, hey.
But you're looking at 2009, 2010, those 2 years where those drafts are not off the good starts. So
and
the
even
2011
like,
draft
it
is
to
pretty
eight,
important.
If we rewind it to 8, Tim Beckham was 1-1. That draft's not off to a good start. I mean, we're at this point. He's done, as you said, he's done some to help bring back his status.
Right.
But
he doesn't look like a star.
He doesn't look like a star, and it was 1-1 in a draft that had some stars who've already starred.
Yes, stars who have starred. There's no doubt. I mean, how different would their organization look? I mean, we'll say it for the millionth time, but really they look a lot different with Buster Posey. I mean, it's just not even – it's almost not worth talking about. But what if they had taken just any of those first basemen? You know, they had Casey Kochman had a great year for them last year. They're looking for a big league first baseman. What if they just taken Yonder Alonso? If you wanted to sign someone for not that much money, I mean, they gave Tim Beckham $6 million plus dollars.
I mean, he can't really play shortstop that well, but what if they just said, okay, well, we'll live with Gordon Beckham at shortstop? I'll just put it this way. He would have produced more offensively. We know that much. They're a defensive-oriented team. They would not have put Gordon Beckham at shortstop.
Right, but. Right. Well, the thing that has taken care of some of that, you know, I think that, again, the perception is the Rays draft so well. I'm not saying they draft poorly.
But they trade
really, really well, and they pick up good free agents. And, I mean, you know, Matt Joyce wasn't a big deal prospect, although he was a sleeper. But when they traded Edwin Jackson for Matt Joyce, I remember thinking, man, all they got is Matt Joyce for Edwin Jackson, and what they got was Matt Joyce, basically a profile right fielder. Obviously,
Ben Zobrist was not something.
Obviously.
Yeah, Ben Zobrist is the. Yeah.
Aubrey Huff into Ben Zobrist, the best draft pick of the last decade for the Houston Astros.
And they never got to enjoy it. But,
they did not
but
get to enjoy
even,
it.
Even with that, you know, and even like Carlos Pena, Casey Kochman, they've managed to turn a couple. Now, Pena, it was a roller coaster ride with Pena. They got good and they got bad.
Right.
But they found something there out of essentially nothing. They found something in Casey Kochman out of essentially nothing. They've managed to do that as well in recent years. Now, if they can find something out of nothing at catcher, they would.
And that's the thing. They've spent a lot of money on trying to get catchers right and trying to develop catchers internally.
And it hasn't happened. They do not have a catcher.
But their 2008 draft, Beckham, Kyle Lobstein, we're all still waiting for Kyle Lobstein. And the rest of that draft class is really. There's not a whole lot going on there. I don't see anybody else out of that draft class that they signed who's a prospect. So, you know, that's what we're that to the Rays, for me, maybe I do see your argument. I can see them ranking ahead of Boston. But I think Boston has leveraged I think draft Boston basically has drafted better than Tampa has the last few years. I think Tampa has traded better. But I think in recent history, and we'll see if this continues, obviously, for Boston, it seems to have continued even after losing Jason McLeod. Amiel Sade and that scouting department there has really kept doing things the same way. We'll see if they keep doing it with Theo Epstein gone.
And we'll keep seeing and see.
I think
For both of these teams, the changes in the draft are going to affect them significantly from the standpoint of
right.
These are late. These are teams that they'll expect never to be picking late.
And you'll never have a team pick 10 out of the first 60 picks again.
Right.
Like
that's not going to happen anymore. The supplemental picks is going to be way down in the number of supplemental picks.
Right.
So that's one thing that's going to affect them. And also, the Red Sox, really, I would argue more than anyone, the Red Sox are the master of, okay, they may spend some money on their first-round pick, but more than that,
they just spread it out.
They just spread it out, and we're going to take 5 to 10 premium guys.
That's right.
And spend a mil, 800,000,
right.
Money like that,
right.
That spreads out your risk. And so it means that, you know, when we're talking about like that 08 draft, and we mentioned Beckham Lobstein. Well, if your draft is based on Beckham Lobstein, you got a lot more chance for that to fail than if it's based on 10 guys.
That's right.
And you go, oh, well, these 5 didn't turn out. But you know what? They got these other 5. 2 of them are star prospects, and 3 others could be useful guys. That's a good draft.
The other CBA change, JJ, since we're talking about that, that's really going to affect the American League East, is international changes and the Yankees. You cannot find, I don't think, a team that's more consistent in terms of always spending a lot of money internationally. And the Yankees, you look at their top 10, well, Jesus Montero, $1.65 million. He was one of the top signing guys in his class. Gary Sanchez with the number 2 signing bonus in his class in 2009. Ravel Santana didn't get a huge bonus, but he did get some money.
And he was considered one of the better.
And he led the Dominican Summer League in home runs in 2010, and then he hit for that kind of power in the Gulf Coast League. I'm leaving somebody out who's ranks pretty prominent. Not so much their top 10, but like in their farm system. And then, obviously, you look at their big league team, Robbie Cano, international. Ivan Nova, international. going back a ways, obviously. Mariano Rivera, international. The Yankees have been as successful, really, as any organization internationally, especially in Latin America.
And they're going to be one of the teams that's going to be hit because they're going to get a smaller allotment.
No doubt. Every change in the last couple of CBAs is basically aimed at less Yankee dominance. You can argue the yes, whether that's a good idea or not, but from adding wild cards, to giving other teams more of a chance, to expanding the playoffs again now, to competitive balance picks, to revenue sharing, all of them are basically aimed at putting a drag on the Yankees.
That's the thing that was interesting. When the CBA came out, there was a lot of hue and cry right at the start that's like, oh, man, this is going to be bad news. Why are they doing this for the teams like the Pirates?
They're killing the Pirates and Royals, exactly.
The team that really, like, if you look at it. Now, again, we do not know. Teams will find ways around some of these things. We know that.
Yep.
Agents will find ways around some of these
things. If they haven't yet, they're searching now.
They're working on it. That being said.
They're down in the mother's basements with the Blazers.
If you said which teams are right now going to be most hurt by these rules, the Red Sox and the Yankees top of the list.
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. They're never going to get competitive balance picks, extra picks like that. They're never going to do that. They're going to keep on paying a lot in revenue sharing, luxury taxes.
But beyond that, yes, it's true that there are some teams, the Royals have probably done it as much as anybody, teams who are small market teams who've realized spending $10 million in the draft is better than spending $10 million for Coco Crisp.
Right.
They've realized that. Okay, that's good and all that. That being said,
it should be pretty evident, but apparently it's not.
But
it's a great way to put it.
But while that's true, teams like that, they're going to get competitive balance picks.
Correct.
The reality of it is they're still, in the bad years, going to pick high. And what this means as far as that is that you're still going to get – you are now going to get more shots at those guys.
Right.
Because, look – the reality of it was before, there were players out there. Not only was it asking price, but you could somewhat manipulate where you were going to end up.
Right.
Because if you tell scouts for 15 teams you don't want to go to that your asking price is $8
million. Right.
And then you tell the team you want to go to your asking price is $3 million, they're going to draft you.
That's
now, a team may screw up your plans. Because they may say, no, we're drafting you. And you know what? We know you're going to take less than
that. I was thinking Detroit taking Andrew Miller, even though he was trying to bluff his way down to Boston and New York.
Right.
I mean, not that it worked out for Detroit, but they did end up trading him for Miguel Cabrera.
Right, but that it can, but that doesn't happen. That's going to be impossible to really happen anymore.
I think it's going to be much, much more difficult. I do think you're still going to have players. The one thing that in the draft that Boston and New York do have is they're still Boston and New York, especially the Yankees. I think the Yankees, I do think there are going to be a lot of players who, when push comes to shove, would not sign with one team for $600,000 in the second or third round, but they would sign with the Yankees for that money. So
that may happen still.
That may happen, but I don't see a lot.
But I'll say this. They're only going to get one shot at that.
That's right. And I'm not smart enough to see all the loopholes yet, but as we know, with every draft rules change, there are always unintended consequences, and one of them might just be driving those players to college, and that would lead us into our next podcast. More than likely, we'll still actually do a central podcast, but I thought that I'd be in Anaheim today, but I'm not for the ABCA convention. Aaron Fitt is. I expect Aaron and Nathan to podcast. I hope that they podcast, and that should be up first of next week, JJ. And then we'll have the American League Central, American League West, and then we take a little break from the prospects. Right when the handbook comes out, we take a little break, and we'll do the college preview issue. But when the book comes out, we'll have a couple podcasts to talk about the book, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
And we've talked about it a little bit. We won't even go into detail yet. This is just kind of wrapping up the podcast, you know, for today. But we do think that there, with the handbook this year, we've added something that will be one of the better additions we've made in years to the handbook that makes it an even more valuable book.
I think so, and I'm excited about it. Kind of can't wait to talk about it, but I am going to wait to talk about it.
Yeah, we'll do a podcast that will talk about that.
That's right. We'll
have it also on the site and all that. So
and
we'll
we
explain it,
and we haven't indicated it at all in the top tens. We want to make sure we got it right for the book. But it's going to be a book only.
It's going to be probably you're going forward. It's a book.
Oh, going forward, it is going to be a book only deal, unless there's such a critical acclaim that we have
even
to include
though,
in the top tens.
You know, even then, I think it's a book. You know, but
I think it's a book only deal. Myself. I agree, but we're obviously excited about that. Excited to have the book behind us. Excited to get it into your hands. So go to baseballamerica.com/store for the Prospect Handbook, the Almanac, the upcoming directory of the Super Register, all the Baseball America books. For J.J. Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on Sunday, January 8th on Sirius 209 XM 89 when the Baseball America show returns to Sirius XM. Until the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.